For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week I talked to Danielle McLaughlin about winning the UK's richest short story prize, the Sunday Times Audible Award.
It's fantastic to have the award putting that spotlight on short stories.
His Dark Materials author, Philip Pullman, explores the background to Lyra's quest.
So the whole aim of the book is to look after Lyra, and that's what the hero Malcolm and his slightly unwilling sidekick, Alice, find themselves doing.
And Hollywood actress Jolie Richardson reveals what it was that profoundly moved her when she visited the RNIB Talking Book Studios.
To those of you at the RNIB, from one of us who cannot see, I am contrite, I feel dejected. It seems my thanks I have neglected.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Danielle McLaughlin has had quite a year. The young Irish writer has won two major literary prizes in 2019. Most recently, the Sunday Times Audible Short Story Award. Her story, A Partial List of the Saved, was described by Judge Blake Morrison as a fascinating portrayal of both cowardice and courage. Danielle joined me down the line from her home in County Cork. Danielle McLaughlin, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
So, A Partial List of the Saved is a story about a couple who are pretending that their marriage is not on the rocks for the benefit of a family reunion. And I understand it was inspired by real events.
It was. It was inspired by the situation of a couple that I know in real life. And while the story is very much fictional, it did serve as, I suppose, a starting out point for me, because I thought, well, that's really interesting to explore the dynamics of that, because I thought it's an interesting situation that perhaps a couple have split up, but yet they get along well enough together that they can put on the show, if you like, for other people. And perhaps it isn't all show. Perhaps there is something there if they're capable of cooperating enough. I was careful, obviously, not to work in any details at all beyond that starting premise that in any way related to the couple that I know in real life. But it was the starting out point for me.
And it's a lovely exploration of how habit blurs the boundaries between where different parts of a relationship lie.
Yeah, I think I've been looking at the idea of hope and room for happiness in my short fiction in more recent times, possibly because hope and happiness is something that we're maybe looking for in these times in the world. But I've been interested in exploring hope and happiness too in relationship challenges. And I've been looking at the idea that when things go wrong, they don't necessarily have to go into a downward spiral of despair, that there can be hope too if we look for that. And it's just as valid to explore the hope and the possibility of a happy outcome as it might be to push the story to its full limits in the darker direction.
Yes, and certainly the two main characters, Connor and Reese, end up exploring the things that they've got in common rather than their differences.
So,
there's a lovely line in there where Connor says, it's less of a lie and more of a kindness to pretend that their marriage is still as strong as it ever was to his father.
Yeah, I think the idea of what is a lie and what is truth is something that I find myself thinking about in terms of fiction, because in a way, with fiction, for example, as writers, we're always making things up and we're putting down on the page things that didn't happen. But in a way, fiction is a great vehicle for the exploration of truth, or trying to think about what might be our truths or what might be other people's truths. So, yeah, maybe we don't always serve everybody's best interests by necessarily telling them everything. And there are times when maybe people don't need to hear all the workings of the insides of our heads. You know, sometimes they're better protected if we don't share everything. And it can be one of the hardest things to judge, I suppose, can't it? You know, when is it right to say something and when is it right to keep something to ourselves, especially in these days of social media when there's a tendency for that line between private and public to be blurred all the time. And in a way, it's almost as if everything is getting shared. And sometimes people are maybe better not knowing something. And maybe it is a kindness if we don't tell them absolutely everything.
And that's certainly hinted at in the title, A Partial List of the Saved, which we find out comes from a newspaper headline.
Yeah, so this was a story that I was writing for a long time. I struggled with it a lot. And that piece of the story came in relatively late in the drafts. And I saw a newspaper cutting with the headline, A Partial List of the Saved, framed on the wall of a pub in Northern Ireland. And the partial list of the saved related to a list of passengers who had been rescued from the Titanic. And it was partial because they hadn't given up hope yet, I suppose, of finding more survivors. So I was very struck by this list and by the idea of it being a partial list of the saved. I thought, that's interesting, this idea of, well, you know, we're still holding on to hope for others who might not appear on this list, but maybe they are out there somewhere too and there's still hope for them. It lodged in my head for a while, and I did also, on a separate occasion, I think, pay a visit to the Titanic Museum in Belfast. So those things worked their way into the story, the core of the story having started off with the idea of this couple who were facing relationship troubles.
Now, the other headline that grabbed me is that 2019 has been quite a year for you. This isn't the first prize that you've won this year, is it?
No, it's been one of those astonishing years, really. And I still have to pinch myself every so often. And I'm still only coming down to earth after the excitement of it all. I was fortunate enough earlier this year to be a recipient of a Wyndham Campbell Prize. And yeah, it's one of those years that feels very unreal, I suppose, especially for a writer of short stories, because it's not the usual sort of year, but I'm just so happy and grateful and still very excited by it all.
We've run a short story competition at RNIB for the last 10 years, and something that's always rather struck me is how overlooked the short story has been in Great Britain. And I do think that one of the fantastic things about the Sunday Times competition, especially now that they are sponsored by Audible, is the focus that it's bringing to the most poetic end of fiction writing, is the way I've always thought of short stories. I know short stories have been more of a feature of Irish writing, but do you feel that there's now more of a movement towards people picking them up and reading them?
Well, we're very fortunate here in Ireland that there's great support for short stories. For example, my own Irish publishers, the Singing Fly Press, have brought out many collections of short stories. And there are lots and lots of literary journals here that are publishing short stories. And that's important, I think, because especially when you're a writer who's just starting out, I think it helps if there's some reality to the idea that what you're writing might someday find its way out into the world and be read by other people. And because there are so many journals who are supportive of short stories here, I know that if I stick with something long enough and work on it hard enough, then yes, there's a very real chance that it will be read by people someday. So for me, that's important, knowing, I suppose, that there's a possibility of finding readers for my short stories. Lots of people maybe don't know that many short story writers, but when they do start reading short stories, they find that they love them. And in fact, if I go back maybe 10 years or so, roughly, to the time when I started writing myself, at that stage, if you'd asked me to name 10 short story writers, I'm not sure I would have been able to. And since then, I have discovered the work of so many short story writers. And I think I became quite obsessed with tracking down even more short story writers, reading all the collections that I could get my hands on. So maybe it's the case that readers aren't always aware of what great work is out there in short stories. But once they do get hooked, then they're hooked for life.
It's an exciting time to be a fan of short stories. You're following in some pretty auspicious footsteps with Kevin Barry, who I know was another Irish short story writer who was shortlisted for this year's prize, and Sally Rooney as well, who, of course, is receiving a lot of attention for her short and long fiction.
They're both such brilliant writers. I can still remember when I first read Kevin Barry's short story collection, There Are Little Kingdoms, and I was totally blown away by that. It rang so true to me. It was so very different to anything I'd read before, and at the same time, it resonated with me in so many ways. So that kind of good writing, it's always an inspiration, I think. Kevin, a previous winner of the short story award and shortlisted again this year. Yeah, I think it's fantastic to have the awards, putting that spotlight on short stories and having that financial support for short story writers as well, because one of the things with short stories is that perhaps they don't bring with them the same kind of financial rewards that writing a novel might. So it's absolutely wonderful to have this very real and very practical support.
Now, I believe there were 950 eligible entries for this year's competition, and they were narrowed down to 6 shortlisted finalists. And unlike another recent literary prize, you were the unanimous choice of the judges. And what's lovely for those of us who are blind or partially sighted readers is that Audible has produced an anthology of those 6 shortlisted stories in audiobook form. You must be delighted that you're reaching a wider audience.
Yes, it's lovely to think that there are so many more people now becoming familiar with my work and being able to listen to the stories. I've recently got into listening to short stories myself because I'm at a stage now where I'm spending an awful lot of time in my car. I'm parent to 3 teenagers and I live in a rural area, so I find that with all their after school and their evening activities, I often spend hours in my car driving around, and it is lovely to spend that time listening to a short story. So I've been listening to short stories a lot more, and that's really lovely experience. I think it's nice the way a short story is, it seems to be just the right length for a shortish but not too short car journey.
Yes, there's something very satisfying about getting the whole of a story in a journey rather than actually having to break in the middle of a chapter and have to come back to the novel when you hop back in the car.
It's great. And what I find myself doing is I'll download a batch of stories, say in advance, to my phone, and then I'll try and match the length of each particular story to the journey that I'm going on. So if I'm going somewhere that's a 20-minute drive, well, I'll say, OK, what have I got that I can hear the whole story in 20 minutes? And of course, with short stories, there's lots of stories that come in under that time, so that's great. And sometimes they'll be just that little bit longer, so I'll find myself maybe sitting in the car for a few minutes after I arrive somewhere, just hearing the end of the story before I go in.
For those of us who would like to hear more of your short stories, I believe you've got a collection out called Dinosaurs on Other Planets.
That's right, Dinosaurs on Other Planets, published in Ireland by the Stinging Fly Press and in the UK by John Murray, and in the US by Random House.
I understand that you're also working on a novel.
I am. I have just recently finished the copy edits on a novel. It will be called Retrospective, and it will be published in the spring of 2021.
Danielle McLaughlin, many congratulations on winning the Sunday Times Audible Short Story Award.
Thank you. It's been lovely to talk to you.
The flight attendant who brought the beer was the same one who'd performed the safety demonstration an hour earlier as they taxied down the runway at San Francisco. In the unlikely event of landing in water, a disembodied voice had said as the woman popped a life jacket over her head. Unlikely hardly went far enough, Connor thought. He hated to be a pedant, but still, it was unlikely that he'd packed a European adapter, but one might yet materialise among the tangle of accessories he'd shoved in his suitcase as the taxi waited by the curb. It was unlikely that the man seated to his left would stop talking any time soon, but it was not inconceivable that some affliction of the throat might set in. It seemed wrong, somehow, that the possibility that they would all be plunged into the icy waters of the Atlantic to have their eyes eaten out by small fishes should be placed on a par with these other, more mundane eventualities. Surely, at a minimum, it was extremely unlikely.
Stephen Hogan narrating A Partial List of the Saved, written by my guest Danielle McLaughlin. A Partial List of the Saved and the other five stories shortlisted for the 2019 Sunday Times Audible Short Story Award is available as an anthology from audible.com. And Danielle will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Hollywood actress Jolie Richardson admits to being profoundly moved by her time at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. But first, His Dark Materials is the hugely successful trilogy of novels by Philip Pullman, which is now a major BBC TV series.
You once asked me what evil was. There are things that you're better off not understanding.
I promised to do everything I could to protect you.
Protect me? From what?
In every child's nightmare, there's an element of truth.
Powers of this world are very strong.
They are stealing children. This is war.
Who is willing to fight for true freedom?
Now is the time to choose a side.
Now, 17 years on, Philip Pullman is back with a new trilogy, The Book of Dust. The first volume, La Belle Sauvage, starts 10 years before His Dark Materials, when Lyra is a baby. It features a flood of biblical proportions, a pair of brave young rescuers, and a cast of sinister spies in a darkly brilliant odyssey of adventures. And I'm delighted to be joined by its author. Philip Pullman, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much.
I know many people, including most of my own family, have reread His Dark Materials several times, but what drew you back into Lyra's world?
Well, in a sense, I never left it, because I've written two little books in between the end of His Dark Materials and the coming of this book. One was called Lyra's Oxford, and the other was a book which I had great fun writing about the first meeting between the balloonist Lee Scoresby and the armoured bear, Yorick Birnison. Called Once Upon a Time in the North. So in a sense, I've been sort of living one foot in and one foot out of Lyra's world ever since I first thought of it. But I could see a longer story gathering, like a storm gathering in the sky, in the distant sky. And I couldn't help being intrigued enough to go back there and think about it and make it into a story.
It's set in Oxford. What do you think it is about Oxford that has produced so many wonderful writers of fantasy and allegory like C.S. Lewis, Lewis Carroll, Tolkien and yourself?
Oh, it's something in the water. At least that's the only explanation I can give. It's an unlikely sort of place. One of the unlikeliest things I ever heard of concerns All Souls College, which in about 1300 or 1400, I can't remember which, at Christmas time was interrupted, or their carol service was interrupted or something, by a duck that flew in. So naturally they caught it and ate it. 100 years later, they decided to commemorate this, and they had a wooden duck on a stick made, which they followed around the college singing Latin hymns. And they've done it every 100 years since, except in the year 2000, when in the interests of sexual equality, they had a female duck rather than a drake. So that's Oxford is the sort of place where that happens. The other attraction for Oxford, as far as I'm concerned, is that I live there and I don't have to go any very far to look things up. And of course, it's got one of the great libraries of the world, the Bodleian Library, which I use extensively.
And I suppose it's also a confluence of scientific and artistic thinking, all within a relatively small area.
That's certainly true. If you want to ask about anything in the fields of science or philosophy or metaphysics or history, there's an expert just down the road at the end of a phone call. And they're generally very, very helpful with their time and their advice. So it's a very hard place to get away from. I suppose the other thing is that once a little tradition has been established, then other people go there and add to it. I can't say whether I went to Oxford because of Lewis Carroll and J.R.R. Tolkien, but I probably wasn't surprised to find myself there because of that.
And is there any coincidence in the fact that one of the heroes of La Belle Sauvage is called Alice? Is it an echo of Alice in Wonderland, perhaps?
No, I didn't think of that until afterwards. And then somebody said, oh, you've written a book about it. Oh, yes, I have written a book about Alice in a way. But it's a very different Alice. There's another connection. I mean, it involves a ride in a boat. And, of course, the original Alice began because Charles Dodgson, Lewis Carroll, went out for a row on the river with a friend of his and with Alice and her sister, I think, the original Alice Liddell. So there's a sort of connection which I can't deny. But I don't think I don't think I did it on purpose.
And the river plays an enormous and very fast-flowing part in the book. One of your Egyptian characters refers to it as the secret commonwealth. Mm. This is something that I believe you're going to explore more in the sequel.
Yes. The flood is very important. The book opens in Oxford, but the flood carries them away, carries our protagonists away, including Lyra, who's only 6 months old or so in this book. So the whole aim of the book is to look after Lyra, and that's what the hero Malcolm and his slightly unwilling sidekick Alice find themselves doing. But yes, the book does become, how shall I say, well, it enters Fairy Queen territory. I mean, Edmund Spenser's Fairy Queen, the immense long 16th century poem, which I never read when I was a student at Oxford, which I should have done. But I read since and found wonderful. And yes, the secret commonwealth is a phrase which I introduced deliberately into the book because that's the title of an odd little book by a man called Robert Kirk in about 1670 or so. He was a clergyman and he wrote The Secret Commonwealth. The full title is The Secret Commonwealth of Elves, Fauns and Fairies, as a means of writing down aspects of folklore, stories about fairies and fairyland and elves and semi-spiritual creatures like that, which I found fascinating.
Are you going to use that as a counterpoint to the organised religion under the magisterium, which is still very much a part of La Belle Sauvage as well?
Well, yes. That's a fairly obvious way to go, but that's the way I'm going. One thing I learned in writing His Dark Materials was not to be afraid of the obvious. It was obvious, for example, as soon as I thought of it, that Yorick Birnison, the armoured bear in the first story, would turn out to be a king in exile. And my first thought when I came to that was, oh, no, that's obvious. Everybody else expects that. It's done before hundreds of times. But then I thought, no, this is what he is. Let's not be afraid of the obvious. So I went for that, and I think it worked. So I'm not going to be afraid of the obvious in this either.
La Belle Sauvage is the craft that Malcolm and Lyra and Alice use to survive the flood. It's also indicative of the fact that there's beauty and savagery in the book, maybe more so than in His Dark Materials. Is that reflective of a greater extremism that you see around you?
I think when I was writing the book, I'd have had to say, no, it isn't. It's just the way the story's going. But since then, and it's taken me a long time to write, since then I see that, it is in a way reflective of things that are happening in the world. The world has not become a kinder, softer, gentler place in the last 17 years. And I think that's going to come out more clearly in the second and the third book, even than it does in the first one.
Malcolm was the landlord's son, an only child. He was 11 years old, with an inquisitive, kindly disposition, a stocky build, and ginger hair. He went to Ulvercott Elementary School, a mile away. And he had friends enough, but he was happiest on his own, playing with his demon, Aster, in their canoe, which was called La Belle Sauvage. A witty acquaintance thought it amusing to scrawl an S over the V, and Malcolm patiently painted it out three times before losing his temper and knocking the fool into the water, at which point they declared a truce. Like every child of an innkeeper, Malcolm had to work around the tavern, washing dishes and glasses, carrying plates of food or tankards of beer, retrieving them when they were empty. He took the work for granted. The only annoyance in his life was a girl called Alice, who helped with washing the dishes. She was 15 years old, tall and skinny, with lank, dark hair that she scraped back into an unflattering ponytail. Lines of self-discontent were already gathering on her forehead and around her mouth. She teased Malcolm from the day she arrived. "Who's your girlfriend, Malcolm? Ain't you got a girlfriend? Who was you out with last night? Did you kiss her? Ain't you ever been kissed?" He ignored that for a long time. But finally, Aster leaped at Alice's scrawny jackdaw demon, knocking him into the washing-up water, and then biting and biting the sodden creature till Alice screamed for pity. She complained bitterly to Malcolm's mother, who said, "Serves you right. I got no sympathy for you. Keep your nasty mind to yourself." From then on, she did.
Yes, certainly you have some unpleasant organisations within the book. I'm thinking especially of the League of St. Alexander, who are a cross between the Stasi and the Spanish Inquisition.
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. Or the Hitler Youth, indeed, or the whatever it was they called the youth organisation in Soviet Russia. Bands of young people driven by a kind of ideology, by a zealotry, and encouraged in this wickedness by their elders. Yes, it's something I found pretty chilling.
Without wishing to give any spoilers, there's also a very unpleasant child molester in the book. Is he there as a reflection of the different ways in which youth can be corrupted, either by ideology or physically?
You could see it like that, but again, it wasn't like that to me, or he wasn't like that when I was writing him. When I was writing him, he was a villain. He was as creepy as I could make him. But as with all villains and villainy, it's more fun to write about them. You can't have people being good all the time. Well, there wouldn't be any story at all.
I know you're very against the labelling of books for age bands or, you know, what sex the reader is. But what guidelines do you impose on yourself when you're writing a book that you know is going to be read by children and young adults?
Well, that's the way I put it. I don't think this book is for 12-year-olds and upwards or whatever. I think this book might include, if I'm lucky, some young people and some older people. That being the case, the only guideline I impose is of telling the story as well as I possibly can. I think, though, yes, having an awareness of a wide audience, which is something I'm very lucky to have, means you have to be, I think, a little extra careful in your storytelling. You can't frighten the grown-ups too much, you see.
That's a lovely way of putting it, yes. And one of your, I think arguably one of your greatest inventions is the demon character. The fact that demons don't take their form until after a child has hit puberty, is that something to do with the nature and nurture debate as to the characters that we assume when we become adults?
Yes, it does. But I'm not specific about it because I want it to be open to interpretation and imagination too. I thought of the demon not at the very beginning when I first began this story. It was just Lyra going into a room where she wasn't supposed to be and things following from that. But I found that was it was something wasn't working. But as soon as I discovered she had a demon, at last they could talk together. And you know, she could say, let's go. And he's saying, no, we mustn't. And she said, oh, don't be such. And so they could talk and advise and console and frighten each other and excite each other and encourage each other. And it made the story work much more easily at that early stage. When I realised that the demon could change shape, I thought, well, yeah, that's interesting. But interesting in what way? What does it do? What does it tell us? And it didn't really tell us anything until I realised that it was children's demons that change shape, and adults' demons are fixed. That was the moment when I saw I could tell a story that I'd been, waiting all my life to tell, really, which is since my own adolescence, which is the difference between innocence and experience, in William Blake's terms.
What form would your demon take?
Well, I don't know, but I think if I had to guess, she would be a bird, and she'd be a bird of the corvid family, one of those birds that steals things. The Jackdaw of Reims, for example, or the magpie in the Tintin story of the Bianca Castafiore emerald. Wonderful, wonderful story. Or a raven, as in Edgar Allan Poe's raven. I think she'd be a raven, really, because the raven is the image of the trickster in many, North American myths, and of the storyteller, too. So I like to think that my demon is a raven.
I believe you based the character of Hannah Relf on somebody who introduced you to books and reading.
The character of Hannah Relf is, sort of some of the circumstances of her life. Some of her way of proceeding is based on a friend of mine, Dinah Birch, who's a vice-chancellor of Liverpool University, as a matter of fact. But that's just the one aspect of her, one aspect of Dinah Birch and one aspect of Hannah Relf. The person who lies behind the story in a deeper sense is my old teacher, Miss Jones, Miss Enid Jones, at Ysgol Ardudwy in Harlech, where I spent my years from 11 to 18, my secondary schooling. She was a wonderful teacher, and she took an interest in me, I suppose, because I was passionate about reading and about books and about writing too, and I was very fond of her.
And it's a great gift to give anybody to introduce them to reading. The heroes of your books do fight back against injustice or threat. I can't imagine you think much of the snowflake generation.
That's an interesting question. I tell you one thing I don't think much of, and that's the word snowflake. Because it implies a sort of wimpishness among people who don't like tough things like right-wing politicians. If you're mildly left-wing, or if you're mildly liberal, you're a snowflake. No, you're not. What a ridiculous way of talking about people. I don't like that term, and I don't like the implication it has that if you're on the left or liberal or something, you're a bit of a wimp. It's not true, and I don't like it.
Yes, and it closes down debate and curiosity, which I think is at the heart of Lyra, Alice, Malcolm, Will. They are young people who learn as they go along.
You couldn't be more right. That's exactly correct. I was once asked, to my great surprise, to preach a sermon in the University Church in Oxford. And so I took it terribly seriously, and I got the kit, you know, the sort of ribbons that go around your neck and the black cassock and all the rest of it. And I stood up in the pulpit, and I preached about virtue. And I talked about the seven Christian virtues, which, of course, begin with faith, hope and charity. And I said, they're all very well, they're all fine, I like them all, I approve of them all except faith. I'm not keen on blind faith. Instead, I'd rather substitute another virtue, which is curiosity. And I like to think that the protagonists in my stories do exemplify this. They are curious. They're interested in things. They're curious about where we come from, why we're here. They've got an intellectual curiosity, a metaphysical curiosity. They're curious about the world and the universe and why we're here. And I admire that and I enjoy it.
We're sitting in the RNIB Talking Books studios where audio copies of books are made. I believe you yourself read the His Dark Materials trilogy for the audiobooks and used actors for some of the parts of Lee Scoresby and so on and so forth.
That's right, yeah. That was a big production. It wasn't my decision to use actors in the parts, but I was very glad they did, although I wanted to do the bear. I always wanted to do the bear. And Sean Barrett did the bear instead. He did it very well. No, I was doing the narration, and actors were doing, including some of the cast of The Archers, which was a strange experience. Lissy Pargeter being Mrs. Coulter. But this time, I simply didn't have the time. It's a long process, as you know, and for someone who isn't professionally involved in it all the time, there are a lot of starts and stomach noises and mistakes and so on. So you have to take a lot longer than professional actors. And we were very lucky to get Michael Sheen to do the whole story this time as a solo, and he did it brilliantly.
Yes, it's a really compelling read. Were you involved in the decision to choose him?
Yeah, he'd got in contact with me and said how much he'd enjoyed his Dark Materials, very looking forward to the new one, and if there was a chance of having anything to do with the new version for TV that's being prepared of his Dark Materials, he'd be very interested in that. Well, at the time, they hadn't begun that, but I did mention that to the producers of the audiobook that Michael Sheen might be a candidate, and he was kind enough to do it.
And will Michael Sheen be reading the sequel?
Well, I hope so, in due course. The sequel isn't ready to be published yet. It's written, but it's not yet edited and chopped about and cut and amended and so on. And I got all that work to do before we can even think of publishing it, let alone making the audiobook.
Can you give us any indication of what's to come in The Secret Commonwealth?
Well, yes. I've said that the first book is, although it's set 10 years before His Dark Materials, is not a prequel. I just don't like that word. And the second part and the third part are set about 10 years after the events of His Dark Materials, but they're not sequels. So it's not a prequel and it's not a sequel, it's an equel. That's my one soundbite that I've been trolling around ever since I thought of it. In the second book and the third book, Lyra is going to be about 20. She'll be an undergraduate. And the consequences of the events and the ideas that are set in place in La Belle Sauvage will be a long time germinating, 20 years or so, but they will begin to sprout and then blossom and flower and produce whatever spines or thorns or poison they do. In The Secret Commonwealth, which is the second book, and the third book, which I haven't yet written.
Are you a man who plans out your books, or do you let them grow as you write?
Oh, I plan them meticulously after I've written them. I have to write it first to see what it's going to be about. I don't know yet when I start. I've got to be surprised, otherwise the thought of working for 7 years to tell a story, all of which you know intimately already, it just chills the blood. I couldn't do it. I'd go mad. No, I do take them apart and put them together again meticulously after I've written them. I think that's the right way to do it.
Well, I will keep my fingers crossed for more armoured bears in the next couple of books. But in the meantime, Philip Pullman, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
To donate £5 to RNIB this Christmas, please text SANTA to 70456. Texts are charged at £5 plus one standard network rate charge. Your special gift will help more blind and partially sighted people get the support they need to live life to the full. Thank you. See Christmas differently with RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, before we return to hear the books of Danielle McLaughlin's life, Jolie Richardson is a star of stage and screen. The daughter of Vanessa Redgrave and Tom Richardson, she is descended from two acting dynasties and began her film career at just 3 years old. Now, alongside fellow Hollywood stars Brad Pitt, Julianne Moore and George Clooney, she's also an ambassador for Save the Children, which is what brought her to the RNIB Talking Book Studios.
Jolie Richardson, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So, how are you enjoying your new departure as a narrator?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, in my dreams, I would be a narrator. So, I would be lying if I said it hasn't been tough, because the book that I'm reading, The Woman Who Saved the Children, about Eglantine Jebb, the founder of Save the Children movement, is very, very long. And it's a tough book in that it's not narrative of such. There's lots of the United Nature thing. You see, look, I'm doing it now. I'm splurging on my words. I never knew there were so many muscles in my mouth. I've become really obsessed by intonation. There have been moments when it's been very tough because it's a long, difficult, analytical book, a scholarly book. It has been the most brilliant training for the muscles in my mouth, for my tongue, if it's all right to say that, just because I don't know. There's something about trying to communicate a story that's different from reading it, obviously. You're saying narrator, but it's not translator because it's not another language, but you're translating it. There is a sort of step in between. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I really consider it an absolute privilege both to be here doing this and this particular book, because I work a lot with Save the Children and I'm fascinated by Eglantine Shebb, so for many, many different reasons. But then to enter this whole world, because it is a particular world of being in the studio, working as a team. I'm very lucky in that I have the gorgeous Pinky and Tamsin, who have guided me through this experience. And actually, if it wasn't for them, because they are expert in terms of producing and editing, of knowing when I've gone off, of needing me to go back. You know, I've just known I was in very good, experienced hands, so to basically do exactly what I was told. I feel that it's been a sort of extraordinary training as an actor or actress.
Yes, I was wondering which I should refer to you as beforehand.
Both.
I know that in the breaks between recording, all the narrators gather in the green room. Have you picked up any tips from any of the old hands in there?
I haven't, actually, because what I've noticed is that everyone's so exhausted when they get to a break, including me, that everyone just sort of plonks and eats their sandwich and it's sort of respite. Do you have any tips for me?
The one that I've heard when I started presenting, I was complaining that my tummy rumbled around about lunchtime and somebody handed me a banana and went, that'll sort it out. It does work. It stops it pretty much immediately and means you can get through another hour or so with no embarrassing gurgling noises.
But is that because of food in your tummy or specifically the powers of a banana?
I don't know. I think it's just because it presumably
pushes
dissolves.
The bubbles down.
Yes, exactly. I don't know. I don't ask questions.
I'm going to this whole sort of analytical thing. Is it the potassium in the banana that stops the bubbles? Well, that's a very good tip. Any more?
Don't drink coffee before you start narrating because it dries your mouth. And always refuse digestive biscuits before you go in and start talking because it sticks your teeth together. I found that one out through trial and error.
Trial and error.
So, in fact, just lay off the biscuits. So, you know, my waistline has actually got far more trim since I started working here. So it's good all round, really.
I have found that come the afternoon, I do have a cup of coffee just because mentally, I think, do you know, the funny thing, since I've started doing this, by extraordinary coincidence and completely independently, my daughter got offered the job to do an audiobook. And then by even weirder coincidence, I was chatting to my mother and I was like, do you have any work coming up? And she said, yes, I'm about to do an audiobook. So three generations of my family, completely independently, have all been doing this the past few weeks, all different books. And so I was trying to give my daughter some tips. I found really it's important to hit the consonants. Mm. You know how when we're chatting we can be a bit more sloppy and we can not hit a T, or there we are, I just did it, hit a T. But then when you're reading a text, or I found with my text, you know, you need the T's, you need all those consonants hit, and then the vowels you can expand a little bit more. But I was just trying to explain to my daughter of how the biggest thing is to stay absolutely present hour after hour. And that's what I found is the exhausting bit, as well as all the muscles in the mouth, you know, to mentally stay very present, to sustain. So I find that come that afternoon, which even in real life when I'm not doing this, I always get a dip. That's where the sneaky cup of coffee comes in.
Well, I must say, as somebody who consumes all his books as talking books, you can really tell when a narrator has control of a book. It is a little bit like going and seeing a play and knowing that the play has a really good director behind it. And it's a pleasure to hear a book well narrated. And I do forget that I'm not reading it myself.
That is really, really fabulous. I do think, like all great arts, you know, when someone's expert at it, it's an insanely beautiful thing. Mm. I certainly hope to get better. I have ever done another audiobook, which was Roald Dahl's Matilda, but it was a much easier book. Mm. And it was many years ago, and it was a much shorter book. But I think I feel in a way grateful that I've had such a tough one first up, because I think they'll seem quite easy. It's funny, you know, people always say to me, my tummy's gurgling. I'm wondering if it's been caught up on the... This is the funny thing. It's just like filming. Your senses become super heightened, don't they, to all the extra noises. When you're filming, it's usually if there's an aeroplane, you're doing a scene and suddenly it's like, oh, I can hear a plane. So the track is ruined. And here, you know, oh, I've like touched that table. That's making a shuffle sound, or the papers, or the tummy, or I need to swallow, and, you know, all these things. But people always ask, like, do you like theatre, television, film? And, I think that they're all part of the same thing, but each has their different area of difficulty, and audiobooks is absolutely within that. I think it's such, you know, when we were children, to be told a story was one of the greatest pleasures as an adult. To be able to listen to a story or to be reading a story is also a tremendous pleasure. It's a gift.
It's an oral tradition as well, storytelling. And I
exactly.
think there's something quite innate in us to like hearing other people telling us good stories well.
I think it possibly is the point of life, right? Because it binds us all. It means community. It means story being told, which is hope. It's everything within the same package. Some actors are brilliant at doing like all sorts of different funny voices. I know that's not my strength. I like to try and hit one note, that moment that you have on some level connected with them. It's that connective moment.
Hit the same wavelength. And
exactly. Mm. That's what I would wish for with narration.
I understand that you saw the poem that is hanging in the green room, which was written by a...
Pete Wheeler.
Yes, who's another blind audiobook fan. Could you read it for the Read On listeners, please?
Do you know what? I'd love to. My first day doing our book, I didn't have my right pair of glasses. And I was really struggling, not only technically, but also visually, because everything was swimming. Obviously, doing this, it was making everything much harder. And I did have a moment of a bit despair of during the coffee break in the green room, thinking, oh, I knew it was going to be tough, but I didn't realise it would be this tough. But in my moment of despair, I'm like, oh, my God, how am I going to sustain? Because I'll tell you why I care so much is because this is a beautiful thing. So I care because I want to get it right. Mm. Anyway, so getting myself a cup of tea, I saw this beautiful poem and I took a picture of it and I actually sent it to my daughter saying, read this when you do yours, because this is how beautiful and important it is. To those of you at the RNIB, from one of us who cannot see, I am contrite, I feel dejected, it seems my thanks I have neglected. And there was me raised to know better, so I pen this poem in a letter. For thanks is far too small a word, a bigger one I'd much prefer, for you fuel a fire that burns so bright in my world of endless night. Each book, a vision in my mind, the only place I am not blind. So when the hours seem long and the work too hard, remember the words of this poor bard. For all you do, you are appreciated, a fact I'm happy to have stated.
Jolie Richardson, thank you so much for giving up your lunch hour. No. Rumbly tummy and all. And I
minus
hope...
the bananas.
Well, I shall look forward to listening to The Woman Who Saved the Children.
The Woman Who Saved the Children, a biography of Eglantine Jebb by Claire Mully, is out now in print and ebook, with that audiobook version on its way soon. Now it's back to Danielle McLaughlin for the books of her life. Danielle, was there a book that you read as a child or a teenager that made you fall in love with reading?
A book from when I was younger, I'm thinking back to my late teens, that really stayed with me and had a lasting impact was Wide Sargasso Sea by Jean Rhys. And that book really made me think about the power of books and challenging narratives. And the idea, I suppose, that maybe stories and versions of stories can be passed down to us, and we don't necessarily challenge the way a story is told or whose story is told or how a story is being told, or that maybe there are stories behind the stories. So Wide Sargasso Sea had a big impact on me, not just as a reader of fiction, and I wasn't a writer, I wasn't writing back then, this was when I was still a teenager, but in the way I think that I approached life or viewed the world, it was an important book.
They say when trouble comes, close ranks. And so the white people did. But we were not in their ranks. The Jamaican ladies had never approved of my mother. Because she pretty like pretty self, Christophine said. She was my father's second wife. Far too young for him, they thought. And worse still, a Martinique girl. When I asked her why so few people came to see us, she told me that the road from Spanish Town to Culebri Estate, where we lived, was very bad, and that road repairing was now a thing of the past. My father, visitors, horses, feeling safe in bed, all belonged to the past. Another day I heard her talking to Mr. Luttrell, our neighbour and her only friend. Of course they have their own misfortunes. Still waiting for this compensation the English promised when the Emancipation Act was passed. Some will wait for a long time. How could she know that Mr. Luttrell would be the first who grew tired of waiting? One calm evening, he shot his dog, swam out to sea, and was gone for always. No agent came from England to look after his property. Nelson's Rest, it was called. And strangers from Spanish Town rode up to gossip and discuss the tragedy. Live at Nelson's Rest? Not for love or money. An unlucky place.
Wide Sargasso Sea by Jean Rhys is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB88, which is narrated by Jeff Hagen. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
A book that I would keep going back to is Kevin Barry's collection of stories called There Are Little Kingdoms. And I never get tired of going back to revisit those stories because the writing is so very beautiful, and at the same time, get so close to our humanity, I suppose, and what it is to be human, and it's a really, really beautiful book.
There Are Little Kingdoms by Kevin Barry is out now in paperback and ebook, though not audio, unfortunately. However, here's a clip of Kevin Barry narrating his recent novel, Night Boat to Tangier, which is available commercially.
Morris Hearn's jaunty, crooked smile will appear with frequency. His left eye is smeared and dead, the other oddly bewitched, as though with an excess of life for balance. He wears a shabby suit, an open-necked black shirt, white runners and a derby hat perched high on the back of his head. Dudish, at one time, certainly, but past it now. You've him tall, Morris. You've manners put on the boy. Charlie Redmond. The face, somehow, has an antique look. Like a court player's. Medieval. A man who'd strum his lute for you. In some meadow-sweet lair. Hot, adulterous eyes, and again a shabby suit. But dapper shoes in a rusted orange tone. A pair of suede Finnish creepers, that whisper of brothels, also a handsome green corduroy necktie. Also, stomach trouble, bags like graves beneath the eyes, and soul trouble.
And finally, is there a book that you'd like to recommend to the Read On listeners that you've read recently?
A book I read recently that I would recommend is The River Capture by Mary Costello. It's an absolutely extraordinary book. I was already a fan of her work. She's a wonderful collection of short stories called The China Factory, and also a novel, Academy Street. And this is her second novel, and it's a remarkable book, The River Capture. It's really beautiful and really different, and I was totally, totally gripped by it.
Lynch's dairy herd are fanned out in the front field beyond the lawn, empty udders swinging loosely. Bulls at the back of the house, cows at the front. He is besieged by Lynch's beasts. Big Frisian cows, heads down grazing, filling up with milk again. Every morning they move in an easterly direction, then curve towards the south like a great ship turning. Such a meek nature they have. He watches them intently. Not as melancholy as the cows of his childhood. Modern cows might be prone to interference from satellite signals, or phone masts, or the electronic bleeps and the spectral wavelengths of light-emitting diodes in the milking parlour. All this turbulence entering their consciousness and changing them, corrupting their nature, dulling their sensibilities. Poor post-industrial cows.
The River Capture by Mary Costello is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Jean-Paul Van Corslet.
Danielle McLaughlin, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Oh, thank you. It's been lovely talking to you.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch.
To donate £5 to RNIB this Christmas, please text Santa to 70456. Texts are charged at £5 plus one standard network rate charge. Your special gift will help more blind and partially sighted people get the support they need to live life to the full. Thank you. See Christmas differently with RNIB Connect Radio.
So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.